Josh, we gotta go back. You gotta come with me.
Back where?
To 2010. July 2010, to be precise.
For what?
You don't understand, Josh. It's gotta do with you. You and your sister.
What, like, we don't become assholes or something, do we?
No, you get trapped in a weird black and white hellscape. You're stuck in limbo.
Welcome, everyone, to Cast of the Past, where best friends get together to sit down and take a look back on some popular video games and maybe some not-so-popular video games.
The treasure trove of old games.
As always, this is Josh.
And Tom.
So, Tom, The year is 2010.
Happier times.
Yes. A whole whopping 8 years ago. And, you know, you're sitting there and you turn on your Xbox 360 and you hear the soothing sounds of the Summer Arcade for Xbox.
Mm.
And one of the first titles that popped up on there was this very dreary, grayscaled game called Limbo. And it was unlike a lot of things that we had at the time.
You're right, Josh. What better way to compliment the summer of Toy Story 3 than one of the most unsettling, depressing gaming experiences that the decade has seen so far?
Yeah. Yeah. 2010 bringing us such great classics like BioShock 2, Call of Duty Black Ops, Assassin's Creed Brotherhood.
You're using the word classic pretty loosely here, Josh.
But we did get some good games like Halo Reach, and we had Alan Wake came out that time. Donkey Kong Country Returns came out. Heavy Rain, Red Dead Redemption.
Red Dead Redemption, that's a legit, I'd apply classic too. But I think it's interesting in that little game we're talking about today has had a pretty, I'd say, enduring legacy in terms of indie titles, even amongst all those big heavy hitters, you know?
Yeah, the summer of arcade that year was crazy because it started with a bang with Limbo and it ended with Super Meat Boy, but we can get to Super Meat Boy at a later time because this entire episode here is going to be about Limbo and the legacy that Limbo has, especially with it just getting released on the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, we thought it'd be a good time to sit down, see how this game's aged, talk about our opinions then and our opinions now.
So Limbo, like I said before, was released during the Summer of Arcade for the Xbox on July 21st, 2010, developed by Playdead Games. And you might be thinking like, oh, what else do I know those guys from? And the only other game that they actually made was Inside, which came out a couple years ago. Playdead Games actually only consists of 25 employees, and yet they made two of the best indie titles, I think, of the past, I mean, as of this, 8 years.
I can certainly vouch for one of them. I haven't gotten to play Inside yet, but it's got a pretty unique and just distinct look to it that I'm sure rivals this game. So whenever I do get around to it, I'm sure I'll enjoy it.
Yeah. So Tom, how did you hear about Limbo?
Well, I heard about Limbo just in the gaming press at the time. Like you said, this exploded in the summer that it was released. You know, it was the subject of a lot of critical acclaim for its look and for its challenging puzzles. So I grabbed it when it came out. I was still in college, so I got it on the Xbox 360, and I think I might have completed it in a day back then. But I have played it a couple times. It's a game that kind of brings you into its world, and it's enchanting in a dreary kind of sense, but still enchanting all the same. How about you, Josh? How did you come across Limbo for the first time?
So I just finished playing Dead Space for the first time, and I was like, oh, I need something that's not going to last a super, super long time. And I was just kind of getting into the whole Xbox Live Arcade, and I was looking to see what are some of the big games that were on there. And at the time, like, nothing was really catching my eyes, but everyone kept talking about Limbo, and there was a bunch of videos, and I think there was like a video or two with Major Nelson on Xbox 360 store talking about the game itself, and I was like, man, that looks really good. I downloaded the demo to it at the time, and I was like, man, like, it seems like something that's going to give me a run for my money, because I love the platforming type games, but I also like the puzzle solving to it, and there was just something about it that this game looked completely different than everything else that I've been playing at the time. And I was like, you know what? I'll spend I think it was like $10 when it came out. I was like, I'll spend $10, pick it up. And I own that game more than I ever should now. Right. I have it on my 360. I have it on my Xbox One. I have it on my PS3. I have it on my PS4. I have it on my Vita. I have it on my Switch. I have it on my computer. I have it on my phone. I have it on my tablet. Like, it's a great game.
Does it rival Shovel Knight for most copies you own?
Yeah, it would be up there. I think, I mean, the only thing that this has over Shovel Knight is I can play it on my phone. This is pretty much the game that got me into those indie titles.
Okay.
I think this is actually kind of like one of the games that kind of started that whole indie franchise to show that these indie games can't be giant blockbusters.
Mm.
You wake up and you're just this boy who has two glowing eyes, and you're pretty much just setting out to find your sister, and you are trapped in limbo. And when you look up a lot of stuff with this game, there's pretty much one phrase that kind of sums up what this story is about. And it's uncertain of his sister's fate, a boy enters limbo. And you pretty much just go from there. The game doesn't hold your hand. It doesn't give you any tutorials. It doesn't hold back its punches from the very beginning of the game.
Mm. Something that I think is interesting about this game is you've just provided the audience with what the official kind of synopsis is to the game. And that's what the developer has stated it's about, you know. But what I thought was interesting when I sat down to replay this game for our discussion today is, like, you get the title screen, and then, like you said, you immediately begin. But if you were to go into this game blind, like, if you just put a controller in someone's hand and said, play this game, I think it's interesting that that plot's not very evident, and you can come out of this game with other interpretations of what it's supposed to be about. I mean, we might get into that as the episode goes on, but it's a very interesting game in that, yes, that's how the developers present it, but the way it uses its atmosphere and its sound design and its world, you can come at it in other ways, I think.
Yeah, and I want to start off by saying how beautiful this game looks in as dreary as a game as it is. The art behind this game, and I'm going to slaughter these names when I say them, but Morten Christian Bramsen and Stein Sorensen made a beautiful, beautiful looking game. And like I said, there's not many colors to it, but just the world that they created and how they did it, and it gave a lot of life to the world for how depressing it actually seems.
So yeah, it's a simple black and white and gray color palette, but the way they use shapes and the leveling of the game's 2D design to mess with, say, camera focus, or just bring puzzles or even enemies out of the background into the foreground or vice versa, it creates this haunting and unsettling look that keeps you on your toes, but also, how can I put it? It lulls you in a way. Like, there's periods where I would just be running through corridors or through forests, and I would kind of just get lost in it and be like, this is creepy but beautiful. And then, like, a threat emerges, and it's not like an unfair surprise. It comes naturally out of the environment, and it catches you by surprise. And then you get tense because you're like, you're trying to figure out how to, you know, solve this obstacle. The look's really great. It reminds me of a lot of, like, kind of some of the all-time great black and white films, like Ingmar Bergman's Seven Seal, just the way it uses the lack of color in a creative way.
When you were kind of blocked with a puzzle or a task or an enemy or something like that, you always felt like all of the horror, and like you said, you get so tense from it. But then when you get into like these areas where you see light shining through, like, it just gives you so much more warmth, though, and it makes you feel determined to actually be able to go ahead and proceed forward. And it's just insane how just three colors really can do so much in a game like this.
Absolutely. While we're on the subject of hope, let's talk about how hopeless the game can make you feel when you fail at some of these puzzles, because this game is very brutal to its main character in terms of tone.
And it is crazy, too, because you are, like I said before, a young boy trying to find a sister. And the fact that this young boy can get killed in so many different and horrifying ways in the game is crazy.
I remember the first time I played this game, and it's one of the more infamous parts of it. In the first level, there is a giant spider, and you have to figure out the environmental cues that'll allow you to defeat him and get by that part of the level, but the spider's giant legs are just these spikes that will one-hit kill you, and by one-hit kill, I mean they will pierce through his skull and come out the bottom of his torso and then just pick him up like a little rag doll and, you know, flail him around in the air while he bleeds out. And it's just so, like, the first time it happened, I just remember, like, jolting, like, whoa, because I was like, that's brutal, and it happened so quick and so unapologetically that it just really caught me by surprise. And that's just, like, the tip of the iceberg for...
Yeah. There is having your body ripped in half by bear traps. Mm-hmm. There's getting gunned down to a bloody pulp by machine guns. Mm-hmm. There is getting electrocuted by giant neon signs. Mm-hmm. There's indigenous people shooting you with blow darts and killing you. There's drowning in the game. And one of the most horrifying, like, interpretations of drowning in a video game, like, I thought, like, Sonic was very, like, oh god, oh god, oh god, oh god, oh god, when you're running out of air. But, like, this, the way that his body just kind of sinks and then floats back up, it's just so disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. As you mentioned, the character's design, he's a black silhouette with two very bright white eyes. And when you just watch his eyes flicker and disappear, it just adds so much more to his death. It's like, geez, like, this kid's getting
destroyed. I'm gonna get into his eyes a little bit later, Tom, when we're breaking down the game towards the end.
Sure.
Because there was something that I noticed about his eyes. I'm going to put a little pin in that one there.
A little bookmark.
We talk about pretty much three colors in this game with the whole grayscale effect.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the sound for a second.
Ooh, very good.
It's when it's there, it's so tense. It sets the mood perfectly of this world that's just, you're in between two worlds.
Yeah, it's all mostly kind of ambient environmental sounds. You know, when you're in the forest areas, you get the hush of just like, like air running through the trees. When you're in the big urban areas, you get these kind of unpleasant industrial sounds. As you said, it's very inviting and you can like lose yourself in it.
Especially when you are coming up onto a puzzle and there's one, like, for instance, there's a bunch of puzzles where it comes to like these giant saw blades. The only sound that you really have is the saw blades going, and it invokes so much fear into the player.
And just to build onto that, the game itself, in terms of how it just does ambient noise, it's so quiet that the loudest parts of the game are the things that trigger your character's death. And I think that adds on to what I was saying earlier, that it's so shocking. So like you said, if you're doing a puzzle and like a buzzsaw is a component, you'll hear the saw. But when your character hits the saw, it's this gross, you know, loud, squishy noise of the saw just cutting you up. And that's so loud that like your death hits you.
Like you see it coming, you know it's happening, yet it happens and you're like, ah, damn it. And there's really no puzzles in this game that feel unfair. There's none that are like talk... it
you, are we segueing into the puzzles now?
Yeah, no. I mean that's but there really are no puzzles in this game though that seem unfair, that like, oh, it was the control's fault that it did this or anything. I felt like if I screwed up in a puzzle or I screwed up, it's because it was my fault.
I agree. There's nothing in this game that is unfair. How do I put this? I guess what I can say is that this is not a game for impatient people. If you're looking to not take your time with Limbo, to like kind of barrel ass through it, some puzzles are gonna kind of frustrate you.
Especially the gravity puzzle.
Yeah. So I'll just be upfront. Playing Limbo in preparation for this episode was the first time I had played it since at least 2013, maybe. A bit of me was like, you know, diligently taking notes for a podcast. And the other part of me was like, I need to, you know, like kind of like a school project. Like I need to get this done. And I wasn't taking my time with certain puzzles and I was dying a lot. And I was like, ugh. There was two or three that I had to cave in and look up online. And the solution was, if I had just paid attention and looked around the environment, they were right in front of my face. And that's something this game is very good about, is that, not like you said, nothing's unfair because they give you everything, but they want you to take your time and settle into the world and use the things that you've learned to get at it. Because when you do get through a puzzle, it's very rewarding, and the game gives you the ability to feel that way. So don't rush things.
especially when you get towards the end, and you'll know because the puzzles will start to get a little bit more difficult and just very time consuming. But don't get frustrated with them, because they really do add to that experience that you're having in the game. But you're talking about taking your time and stuff like that, and you mentioned about, you know, some of the puzzles giving you issues, Tom. What was your least favorite puzzle?
My least favorite puzzle in this game, I'll be straight, a lot of them involve water, because water is just one of the most frustrating one-hit kills that can happen to you in this game. I would say my least favorite puzzle is probably around chapter 10, and I will probably not do as great of a job as describing this in audio form as visual form could do, but essentially involves raising the water level of a room and making sure that a box floats concurrently up with you so that you can stand on the box to avoid drowning. But there's a series of ways that you have to rearrange platforms in the room so that the box rises up. Otherwise, the box doesn't rise and you get trapped in the water and drown. It was just one of those examples of I wasn't taking my time, I was rushing it, and I couldn't find the platform that I had to specifically rearrange, and thus I would keep drowning. And then I looked it up.
If I'm not mistaken, this is the one where you have to also have the tire float up and go underneath the box, correct?
That's the tail end of that segment of the game.
Okay.
So you're around what I'm talking about, but this is, like, I would say the first step of that puzzle.
Okay.
But yeah, specifically the water puzzles always got to me, and that one in particular took me a while because I was like, ugh, I just want to get around this. Mm-hmm. But how about you, Josh? Do you have a least favorite puzzle?
Every time those stupid things attach to your head.
The brain slugs.
Yes.
Can you tell our audience about the brain slugs?
Yes. So you're walking through the forest and you're walking through caves, I believe. And there's these little white, like, slug things that are on the ceiling. And when you walk underneath one, it falls and attaches itself to your head. And you were kind of given a little glimpse of this earlier when you see one of these characters that were trying to kill you throughout the game come walking just out of the cave and drown himself in the water in front of you. And he has one of these slugs on his head. So you're like, oh, that's kind of weird. So the thing gets attached to your head and you can't move your character. It moves for you. And the only thing you can do is jump and speed up forward, which sucks. So as you're continuing to walk, the sun actually will come through the cave and hit your head, which will turn this slug thing around. So you'll start walking in the opposite direction then. So you're like, okay, so now I can only go in the way I need to go if I'm in the sun, but the sun's not here. And the first time you do it, it's like, okay, like, I gotta get over here, but there's a box that's blocking me and I have to get this box, and then how can I get this thing off my head? And then you go into the sun, and then he ends up turning around again for the second time, and then you have to push this box. But as you're walking, you have to push the box, climb on top of it, and jump up for these creatures that are in the ceiling to eat the slug off of your head. It took forever. And I that was one of those, like, I kind of rage quit for a while until I was like, I gotta calm down. There's something I'm missing here. I don't understand what it is. And I did it. And then later in the game, there's another one that involves running and jumping through pipes. And then there's water. And then you have this possibility of drowning. And there's saws. And it's like they just amped it up like 20 times later in the game. And those two puzzles are the most infuriating things in this entire game. But when you're done with it, you feel so accomplished though when you're done.
So you want to talk about the ending right now? Do you want to transition into that?
I mean, yeah. Towards the end of the game, you start to realize that your puzzles deal more with gravity. And then you're listening to more sound cues to figure out when you need to jump at certain times where the gravity is going to actually shift in the world. And then you have to reverse gravity in midair. When you get to the end, there's a really nice puzzle where you have to do pretty much this rhythmic 3-point turn, and it's going to actually launch you through this glass. When you come through the glass, you realize that you've pretty much broken through limbo, and your character wakes up there in pretty much the same exact spot that he began the game, and he starts to walk forward, and you see his sister sitting there, and she's like, it looks like she's kind of like digging in the ground or something like that. And then she looks up, she just lifts her head up, and the game goes right to black. It cuts to black. It's one of those games that kind of leaves it up for interpretation to what you think happened, what you think happened through the entire game. Reading some things, I noticed a lot more, because I had my own interpretation of thinking like, okay, well, he finally found her. Like, you would think that's it. But then going in deeper, there's so many different theories out there of what people think happened in this game. Mm. And before I go through any of those, Tom, I want to know, what did you think happened at the end?
I think when I first played in 2010, I just kind of took it as a straightforward acceptance of what Playdead said the plot was. You know, you're a boy, you're trying to find your sister, you go through this incredible world, and then you find her. And then, like, you know, the end is kind of, like, jarring in that it's, like, you don't get a full payoff. It's just, like, all right, you're there, but what does it really mean? In playing it recently, I honestly was kind of looking at this game as maybe a allegory for kind of depression and anxiety, with the boy's quest representing more of like the obstacles that can kind of be put in front of us while we try to make connections to people. You're dealing with a lot of horrors that seem a little bit exaggerated and over the top. And the only other time that like actual humans are present in the game besides the boy and his sister, they're always very hostile. They're always threatening you, trying to come at you. If you've ever dealt with like depression or anxiety, it's just something that kind of seems familiar, where the simplest tasks, in this case, like the boy's trying to find his sister. So maybe that's a guy trying to have a conversation with someone who's close to him, or maybe trying to have a conversation with someone for the first time. But there's all these obstacles there. And it's like, are these obstacles built up by the main character themselves as a means of like, you know, I can't talk to that person, and these are like all the reasons why, like, you know what I mean? Like when you're dealing with crippling anxiety or stuff like that, simple tasks seem like a challenge. So I kind of looked at this game as maybe that's what it was a commentary on. And at the very end, he's breaking through the glass, you know, like he's just throwing himself into a scenario where I'm going to do it, I'm going to connect with another person. And then that ending, the reason it cuts out like that is just like, okay, whatever happens, this character has overcome their obstacles, and that it's on them at that point.
Yeah. And it's weird how you said you played it back in 2013. I played it back in 2010, 2011-ish. You know, 5 to 7, 8 years of playing this game, how our idea of what happens in this game changed so much.
Yeah.
Like, we both were kind of like, okay, well, he found his sister at the end. That was it back in the day. And now it's like, oh, now, no, there's so much more science behind this. It reminds me of that meme with Charlie Day trying to figure out and connect all the strings together from It's Always yes. Sunny in Philadelphia.
It's one of the most accurate memes ever. But what about you, Josh? How have you come to interpret this game?
So I think more of what is actually happening in the game to the character. And there's some things that I noticed in the game that maybe might further the story a little bit more. So when you first start the game off and you're on the title screen there, you see a ladder, and then up top there, it looks like kind of like a treehouse, right?
Yes, right behind the logo.
Yes. So when you get to the end where his sister's at, that ladder is destroyed. Like, the bottom part of that ladder is destroyed, but the treehouse is still there. So I'm wondering if the treehouse had something to do with where we ended up in the game.
Okay.
I actually did a little bit more research because it just seemed kind of, it was like, huh, I didn't think about that.
Right.
But
it clearly wouldn't have been put there unless it had some kind of intent.
Correct. Correct. So going back into the, I'm going to take that pin out from before, the boy's eyes, right? Mm. He's the only person's eyes that you see in that entire game.
That's true. That's true.
Even when you're in the real world, when you break through limbo with his sister, you don't see her eyes. The people who are trying to kill you, you don't see their eyes. The spider, you don't see its eyes. Mm-hmm. All the dead people in the game, you don't see their eyes. Is everyone dead in the game? Are you dead in the game? Like, there's so many other things that, like, there's so many other theories now that I've been seeing, I've been reading and trying to figure out. So one of the big ones that people talk about is the boy actually dead from the beginning? Is he dead? And this is pretty much his personal hell, where he's just constantly going through these trials and tribulations to try to get out. And then at the end, his sister finally realizes that he's dead.
So he's a ghost trying to cross over, and the end is like her seeing his ghost in a way, or
not even seeing, but acknowledging. So like I said, the ladder for the treehouse, what happens if he was at the treehouse, he was coming down, fell off of it, died.
Okay.
And then at the end, she realizes like,
oh
my God, he's dead.
Oh damn. Hang on a second. In my playthrough yesterday, there is a puzzle that lends credit to this. I believe it's around chapter 12 or 13. You are forced to run through a series of obstacles because of a brain slug. And you get to a point where you see, up on a ledge that's easily jumpable to, you see the silhouette of a girl, light, and a ladder. And you're like, oh, if I didn't have the brain slug, I could just reach that. But it forces you to keep going. And then when you come back to that, it's gone. Like, that ledge is gone. The girl is gone. It's something else. But, like, when you were running past it, there's light on it in a way that's like, oh, if you could only get here.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like, when I did it earlier, I remember, like, what was that? But now that you're talking about it, I'm like, okay, so that's, I can't believe that that was accidental anymore, given your theory.
Right. Right. So it's more of a, and I know it's very depressing to say it, but it's like, is this more of a doomed to repeat type thing where he's just kind of stuck because of something that happened in the real world that he's constantly having to relive this now over and over and over again?
Some bummer material.
Mm-hmm. But that's one of these. That's what the thing, though. The game is really meant for you to interpret it however you want. I know there's a whole theory out there that the boy and the girl were in a car accident, and him breaking through is pretty much him reenacting the car accident that happened. That the sister is actually dead the entire time, and he's trying to cope with he thinks it's his fault that she ended up dying, and it's his way of trying to cope with that. There's a really good theory that I was watching on YouTube about a guy who pretty much thinks that this game is an interpretation of Dante's Inferno.
Mm-hmm. All the levels are circles in a way.
Yeah, if it was meant to be that, I mean, there's a really good theory there on that as well.
Okay.
But everyone who plays this game is probably going to have a different mentality coming out of it, or a different theory of what could have happened and how this happened and who are these people and where did this happen? Why are there these giant wheels and cogs and stuff like that you're climbing, and what does that actually mean to the real world? And it's just crazy how much little detail there is in the game that could actually take this so much farther for people.
Right. Yeah. And all in a very short game, too. It's not very long. You can easily complete it in about a 3-ish, 4-ish hour span.
The fastest playthrough I ever did of it was probably like an hour and 15 minutes. I was going for the final achievement that I needed on Xbox, which is you have to beat the game in one sitting and die less than 5 times. And I died 9 times.
Huh.
And it pissed me off. And it's like stupid ones too. It was like, oh, like the bear trap at the beginning, like if like you're like, I ran an extra like step that I needed to or something like that. It was really stupid stuff. But
I believe these records are the most up to date, that the world record speed run to complete the game at 100% is 49 minutes.
Yeah,
so that's how quickly the game can be beaten if you kind of, you know, master it in a way.
Let's go into talk about a little bit more of the legacy. We talked about pretty much this game has come out on every console
yes.
known to man.
It's a very simple game. I imagine it's not difficult to port.
Back in 2010, it was actually the third highest selling Xbox game on the Xbox Live Arcade. It generated around like $7.5 million in revenue.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Like I said, this is kind of like one of your OGs when it came to indie titles on your mainstream consoles. We didn't have anything like this, you know, on the original Xbox or the PS2 or anything like that. And then the 360 came along. We had the Summer of Arcade, and it was like, blah, here's Limbo. Here's Super Meat Boy, here's Peggle, here's Zuma, here's, you know, Plants vs. Zombies, like all of these huge games that just came out at one time, and it was just super overload.
Mm-hmm.
When, I mean, it won a lot of awards at the time too, so it was named Game of the Year, Best Indie Games, Best Visual Art at the Paris Games Show back in September of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
It received the most nominations at the 11th Annual Game Developers Choice Awards, earning 7 nominations, including Best Debut, Innovation, and Game of the Year awards, but ultimately won 4 Best Visual Art, because for something so simple, like, and think about like games like this, where it's taken the indie genre nowadays, to games like Cuphead.
Oh yeah, I get you completely. I agree that it kind of put indie games on the console market on the map. All the acclaim it got is well-deserved. I think it's a very tight and very well-made game with a lot of artistic creativity behind it, in both it the way it's conveying a message and also being like a really inventive and challenging puzzle game. It's just really good all around. This is maybe a hot take, and it's a theory or an opinion I can't prove, but I'm just going to throw this out there. I would not be surprised if the way that this game so deftly handled ambient music that, as we talked about earlier, the soundtrack isn't big and blasting and in your face. It's all like, here's the sounds of the world around you and the way that can bring you into the world of the game. It reminded me a lot of what Nintendo did with Breath of the Wild. You know, that has a very quiet, almost non-existent soundtrack, because in Breath of the Wild, you're just listening to the sounds of nature, the sounds of the environment around you. And any music that does come in, it's only for like important reasons, and you still get engaged without the music, you know what I mean? Because the sound design is so great within the world that it just hooks you. I wouldn't be surprised to learn at some point if like Limbo encouraged more sound designers to go that route, and that's how we get more efforts like that today. Can't put money on it, but I would not be surprised.
So with closing statements on this game, Tom, mm-hmm. would you recommend Limbo to people nowadays, even though it's 8 years old?
I think Limbo is a very interesting piece of gaming history, and I think it definitely should be experienced. I'll say this. I had it on Xbox 360. When we decided we were going to choose this for the podcast, I bought the Switch port because I figured, you know, oh yeah, it's appropriate. I should try it on something new to see how it feels. And I paid $10. I feel like Limbo should be cheaper. I don't know. Maybe it's controversial, but $10 for like a four hour experience, your mileage may vary. For me, I was like, I already had this on the 360. I should have just maybe stuck with it. What I'm saying is, if you have not experienced Limbo, you should pay to play it, because it's a great game. If you're interested in ports, just kind of be conscious of like, do I already have this? Because maybe you don't need it on a system for certain prices. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, the game at $10, it's 8 years old, and I understand that. I mean, a lot of indie titles and stuff like that. I think Super Meat Boy is still selling for like $20, and they came out around the same time. Now you're getting much more longevity out of Super Meat Boy. At $5,
Super Meat
Boy
is also,
that would be...
Sorry, real quick. Super Meat Boy is also longer, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like that's what I just said. You're getting much more longevity out of it. Okay. But with Limbo, I mean, $10... that's probably the max I would recommend someone to pay for it. Every now and then it does drop for like $5 and stuff. I will say I haven't done it yet, but I've gotten all 10 hidden eggs inside the game. But there is a hidden area in the game as well where you go through this like really elaborate puzzle in like next to pitch black. And it's pretty crazy. If you ever want, you can just Google search or YouTube search that. They call it like the epilogue to the game. It doesn't actually continue the story. It's actually just a hidden area that you have to find these 10 hidden eggs, and it unlocks this secret room that you can go in and do this last puzzle. And it's kind of crazy. It's I've watched some videos to it, and I'm fine with just playing the main game.
But no, that kicks ass, because that shows you that there is more in there for people willing to, like I said, be patient with the game, explore every nook mm-hmm. and cranny. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, $10 is probably the max I would pay for it. I mean, I own it so many times and will constantly keep playing it because it's something I'll go back to because it's one of those things like, you know what, I have a couple extra minutes here. I'll sit down and play a couple of the puzzles here and progress my story and keep going. I think it's a fantastic game, and I think everyone should at least try it once just to see what all the hubbub's about and kind of see where the indie games kind of started.
I would agree that this is a unique kind of artistic achievement in gaming. This is the kind of game you could make very easily the argument that gaming's a unique art form that should be taken seriously. And it's really great. Just designed well from top to bottom, interesting and full of cool ideas. And it's a conversation starter, so definitely try Limbo out.
While we boot up the Triflex Capacitor, please take some time to subscribe to the show and leave us a review wherever you listen. This show is nothing without you, and any support helps.
If you want to connect with us and discuss the past, present, or future of gaming, check out Bad Elephant Gaming on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And don't forget to watch our other videos on YouTube, where we bring you gaming experiences you'll never forget.
We also have a Twitch channel where we play games for the show and for fun. Come chat with us anytime at twitch.tv/badelephantgaming.
Thanks for listening.
And until next time, we'll see you in the future.
Fireworks are the stupidest thing to spend money on.
Mm-hmm.
You are actually paying to light your money on fire.
Yes.
I just, like, but people pay, like, hundreds of dollars on fireworks.
But they go, pah!
Oh.
And they go, pew!
Ah.
And they go, those are the noises of money well spent.
Yeah. I can't understand, like, why people want to spend money to just light it on fire for, like, not even 3 seconds of enjoyment.
I don't know.
Good. Oh, that was green.
I haven't seen a green one yet.